Provost Griffith, ladies and gentlemen, it's a real privilege to have this opportunity of being with you tonight and having the chance to discuss a subject that I've been assigned, democracy and the challenge of peace. We're living in the most decisive period in the history of the world. Democracy faces a challenge in peace as compelling as the challenge that it faced in war. And what we do in America in the mobilizing democracy to meet this challenge in peace is going to decide the future of mankind all over the world. In the Cold War, we fight forces as deadly and destructive of basic human values as we fought in the war, accepting that the forces are less tangible and in some respects more difficult to counteract. In the Cold War, history has made America the custodian of freedom. And what we do in America in the next several years will decide whether or not the light of freedom will burn more brightly in the world, or whether it might possibly be extinguished all over the world. If we fail, then the people of the world have no chance of making democracy secure or making freedom secure. As you look around the world and you look at the tremendous progress we've made, you realize that never before in the history of mankind has the future held such great promise, and never before has it been so pregnant with disaster. The Cold War is not a struggle for geography. The Cold War basically is a struggle for men's minds and their hearts and their loyalties. We've got to meet the challenge of the common form if we're going to win the hearts and the minds and the loyalties of people all over the world. We've got to meet the practical challenge of the common form, not by an eloquent recitation of pious slogans about democracy's virtues, but by a practical and tangible down-to-earth program of social action that gets to the core of the basic problems of the great mass of people throughout the world. The greatest challenge that democracy faces in peace is to find a way to develop the social mechanisms by which we can translate technical progress into human progress and prove to the world that it's possible for free people to achieve economic security without sacrificing their basic political freedoms. The H-bomb has created a serious moral and political vacuum in the world. At no time in the history of the world have the people who believe in the democratic faith needed the strength that they need today to meet the problem that the H-bomb has created. We have the practical job of filling this tremendous political and moral vacuum created by the H-bomb, of filling that vacuum with positive human and democratic values. Because if we fail to fill it with positive values, the apostles of fear and hate and hysteria will move in, and they will create the kind of world environment that will make war inevitable. Our economic, political, and military crisis in the world is fundamentally a moral crisis. The H-bomb did not create this dilemma. The H-bomb merely dramatized it and brought it home in a more emphatic way. The dilemma that men face in the world today is fundamentally a moral dilemma that grows out of the fact that we have made great progress in the physical sciences, and there is an ever-increasing and dangerous gap between the progress that man has made in the physical sciences and the lack of comparable progress in the human and social sciences. We've learned how to split the atom. We've learned how to build the H-bomb. But we have not learned how to feed people in the world when there's enough to eat. We know how to work with materials, but we as yet have got to learn how to work with people. And that's the great challenge that American democracy faces in peacetime. It's the challenge of finding a way through positive and practical programs of social action to assure that technical progress will be reflected in terms of human progress, in terms of human happiness, human dignity, and human security. In the Cold War, democracy will win. Democratic allies throughout the world, only to the extent that it is able, in a practical and tangible way, to match its noble promises by practical performance. Because you cannot sell democracy with slogans. You've got to sell it by practical achievement if you're going to win the Cold War. The tragedy in the world scene is that too often in too many places, people are being given the choice of one extreme or another extreme. It's this growing crystallization of extreme positions in the world that threatens democracy. The choice in the world will not be found in either the extreme on the right or the extreme on the left. Communism, fascism, and all other forms of totalitarianism offer mankind the promise of economic security at the price of political and spiritual enslavement. On the other hand, we cannot accept the false doctrine of those irresponsible, socially blind exponents of Wall Street monopoly capitalism who would have us believe that human insecurity is the inevitable price which men must pay for freedom. We have the practical problem in America of proving that both bread and freedom can live together in democracy's house. That to have freedom, you don't have to give up economic security. And to achieve economic well-being, you don't have to give up your freedom. That both are possible. And the thing that we've got to make clear is that the choice in the world is not between the Kremlin or Wall Street. That our answers will be found neither in the dogma of Karl Marx or in Adam Smith. The answer will be found down the broad democratic middle, where we achieve a moral balance between the values of economic security and political and spiritual freedom. Now, we have learned at great cost in two world wars that peace is indivisible. We are learning now that freedom in the world is indivisible. Neither peace nor freedom can be made secure in this modern world of ours unless they both rest upon a broad foundation of economic and social justice. We in America possess a fuller measure of freedom than the people of any part of the world. But we've got to realize that freedom not only bestows rights and privileges, it also bestows obligations and responsibilities. Because in this world of tension of ours, freedom is not a luxury to enjoy like a new Easter bonnet or a steak dinner. Freedom is a weapon to fight with and a tool to build with. And we've got to use it that way. Because people all over the world, hungry, desperate people who are digging themselves out of the rubble of war, are looking to America for the answer. They're looking to see what we do with American democracy and the freedom that American democracy gives us. They know, as we ought to know, that unless we can make democracy work in America, it cannot be made to work any place in the world. These people who look to America for the answer realize that the American economy is freedom's greatest material asset. What we do with the American economy, how effectively we mobilize its productive power, and how intelligently we distribute the products of that economy, both at home and abroad, can be the decisive factor in winning the Cold War and getting on with the job of building the peace. We're sending food and clothing and machinery, all sorts of material things to the people of Europe, helping them in a material way to rehabilitate their economic life. And we've got to continue to do that. But we've got to realize that they need more than just material aid. They need hope. They need the kind of spiritual aid that we can give them only if we prove that American democracy has the moral strength and the practical, down-to-earth economic and political know-how to come to grips with the basic problems of the great mass of people and find a solution to those problems. What we do about these practical problems is the thing that's going to decide whether or not those hungry people in Europe and other parts of the world are going to be convinced that democracy can solve these basic problems. I participated in a trade union conference in London last December. There were 250 delegates there representing 48 million workers throughout the free world. And we talked for 10 days about the basic social and economic problems that are affecting people all over the world. These are people, many of them living in the shadow of the Iron Curtain. Many of the trade union leaders that I met with spent years in the worst fascist concentration camps. Some of them were working behind the Iron Curtain. And they said to me and the other American delegates, "We are more concerned about the possible development of a future depression in America than we are concerned about the H-bomb." Because they said that if you aren't able to solve the basic problem of unemployment in America, and if the American economy drifts so that you have another depression with mass unemployment, that such a depression will give the common form a more potent weapon in the Cold War, a weapon more devastating than a large stockpile of H-bombs. So every time the newspapers say that unemployment in America was 3.5 million, as it was a year ago, and it went up to 4 million, and now it's almost 5 million, that news is seized upon by the communists, and they feature that in their papers. And they say, democracy cannot solve the basic problem. And workers who are searching for the answer to their fundamental human problems are confused. There's uncertainty. There's fear in the hearts of our allies every time unemployment increases in America. The communist masters in the Kremlin know they can't beat America. The Cold War is being dragged out because they think perhaps America will defeat itself by permitting a repetition of what happened in 1929. And if that happens again in America, this time we may lose more than just our jobs and our homes and our farms. We may lose our freedom, because that's the kind of a delicate situation we have in the world. Either we make the American economy work, or we undermine the very foundation upon which freedom and democracy must rest. Now, those people in America who cry aloud against the welfare state